This is Car Expert.
Genesis really needed SUVs. GV80 is a very, very impressive SUV.
It's now clearly the number three ute. D-Max, seriously solid stuff.
Thank the Lord there is a new steering wheel that won't beep when you go around roundabouts, which is honestly the thing I'm most excited about.
Hello, my name is Mandy Turner, and g'day to Paul Marrick.
Mandy, hello.
And Scott Colley, hello.
Hello, hello.
Now, what do I hear on the grapevine? You have a new car, Scully.
I do have a new car, Mandy, and it's sort of come through sad circumstances. It was my grandpa's, but he passed away a couple of weeks ago. But yeah, I'm the one who has ended up with his car, and actually, I'm going to put it to you two to start with. What do you think it is?
Well, I know what it is, but I can give Mandy a hint. Mandy, if you were to open up a Spanish translator and type in a word that starts with W and ends in anchor, I'm going to tell you what it is.
Yeah, it's a Mitsubishi Pajero, a 2005 model. And apparently, as Paul has informed me a number of times now, Pajero means wanker in Spanish. So it should suit me just fine. But yeah, it was his, and he had it since new for 15 years. And I'm getting a roadworthy this weekend so I can transfer the registration across, which shouldn't be too stressful because he was a very meticulous man. It's been very well looked after. But it's really reminded me how a car can be a time capsule for a particular person, because when we went to pick it up, it's got paper maps for every single place he's taken it towing in Australia in the glove box. It had fuel use and distance records from 1992 from the caravan holidays he used to take in his Holden. And things like his compass and his pocket knife and everything were still in the glove box that have now gone out to different members of the family. But it just, every time I sit in it, even though it's been cleaned and, you know, given a good wash, it smells like him, and it reminds me of being a kid in the backseat going to Science Works or going for picnics with them. It's such a perfect encapsulation of everything that we did in that car and he did in that car. It's kind of, I sort of sit in it, it just smells like him.
So
that's lovely.
But yeah, it's going to make it hard to, you know, eventually if you ever do sell it, to get rid of it, you know, because it means something more to you than what it's worth as a sort of secondhand vehicle.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think at this point the plan is to hang on to it for a little while, and I've got, you know, younger cousins and members in the family who will eventually need a car, and I don't know. By that point, I might have driven around Australia with it, or it might have been sitting there. But yeah, you know, there's other people in the family who need a car and want to drive it as well. So I think the plan is to keep it in the family and yeah, keep it ticking along, because mechanically, from what I've read and from what I've experienced with it so far, it seems pretty bulletproof. It's got the 3.2 litre diesel engine, and it's done 175,000 Ks, but it feels pretty tight to drive, to be honest. So yeah, my immediate plan is to get it roadworthy and then challenge Paul Marrick to a drag race.
Excellent. All right, I'll get my my legs ready.
I'd love for you to write a review on this car. I know it's not a new car, Scully, but it'd be great for you to write about it.
I've got the bones of a story about it already written. I'm just going to wait for it to get roadworthy, and then I'll take some photos and I will publish something, because yeah, I've got the bones of sort of what it means to me, and it's actually, I'm not a particularly sentimental person, but I feel a bit sentimental about the car. And yeah, I'll also talk about how it drives and what needed doing to make it roadworthy again.
Mm. Have you driven the new or the latest Pajero?
I have. I've driven the last of the Pajero, and then I've also driven a new Pajero Sport. I think the thing that stands out most to me about the 2005 car is how small it feels, because it doesn't have, even though it's got a big 3.2 litre engine, excuse me, in the nose, it's got quite a short bonnet. It's got a really big glass house, and it's also got an aftermarket reverse and camber and parking sensors that were installed, we'll call it questionably. But the sight lines are really good, and the engine, which is nowhere near as clean as a modern diesel engine, has really good torque. It actually picks up quite quickly, although on the highway it's only a 5-speed automatic, so it's not quite as settled as a modern Pajero. But yeah, because it's so easy to see out of, and because the engine is quite punchy, it actually doesn't feel 15 years old to drive. It sort of feels like a distant relative of a modern Triton or a modern Pajero Sport, or a not-so-distant relative of the current Pajero, which is just the same car underneath, essentially.
Starting off with this week's car news, probably the biggest news of the week, Scully, the 2021 Nissan Navara has been revealed.
It has, and it looks like a Navara that's a bit tougher, but the big news is under the skin, where Nissan has given it a big safety boost. We've seen a huge swing towards safer utes in recent years. The Hilux now has a full suite of safety kits standard from base, as does the Ranger, D-Max, BT50 and Triton. The Navara now has autonomous emergency braking, driver attention monitoring and forward collision warning standard from even the base model. And everything above the base model now gets forward collision warning, autonomous emergency braking, lane departure warning, trailer sway control, rear cross traffic alert, and blind spot monitoring, which, given ute drivers are among the people who drive the most on our roads when they're tradies and they're getting around from job to job, is a really big step forward. Of course, there's more to it than just the safety stuff, though. The new Navara has what I think is a pretty sharp new look. Not everyone necessarily agrees. Inspired by the Titan from overseas. And there's a new range-topping Pro 4X version, which picks up where the N-Trek left off and gets some black body add-ons, gets some tougher wheels and some red accents, along with some pretty cool stickers at the back that are kind of like a Baja truck. I personally think it looks quite sharp. The engines will carry over from the pre-update model. So there's a base model with 120 kilowatts of power and 403 newton meters of torque, that will only be offered on very base manual variants in a single cab chassis. From there, there's a twin turbo version with 140 kilowatts of power and 450 newton meters of torque. And that's coupled with a few sort of, call them detail changes under the skin. There's a stronger rear axle and rear suspension tweaks to up the payload to 1.2 tons on some models. There's also a new steering rack, and thank the Lord there is a new steering wheel that won't beep when you go around roundabouts, which is honestly the thing I'm most excited about in this.
Yeah, I was about to say I agree. The steering wheel is probably the biggest thing I'm excited about, because that was so frustrating. Every U-turn, it would be honk, honk, honk.
For those who haven't driven a Navara, the horn insert in the wheel, rather than just stopping on the center boss of the wheel, actually ran all the way down to the base of the wheel rim. So when you crossed your hands over or turned the wheel, which you had to do quite a lot in the original NP300 Navara because of the steering tune on it, you would hit the bottom of the horn and honk unsuspecting pedestrians, drivers, and just look like an absolute tosser. You would look so stupid. So I'm very glad they fixed that.
Agreed. I had the chance to actually check this thing out in person, and we shot a video that is currently embedded in Scott's article at the website. Look, I'll go through things I like. The first, the headlights look fantastic. So the Pro 4X model has these really cool individualized LED lamps, very similar to the Patrol update with that C LED shape. I think that looks really cool. It looks far beefier. So they've gone to town on the appearance. I love the new paint color. We had a look at a slate gray that was on display, and that looked pretty cool as well. The interiors had a subtle update as well. So it retains Apple CarPlay, Android Auto, and there's a new screen ahead of the driver too, plus a 360 camera that now adds kind of like an off-road mode. Well, I say it adds it, but I remember the Warrior having this, so I'm not entirely sure exactly what changes with it. So yeah, look, they're the good things. Looks pretty sort of tough in person, and also the increase in payload. It's 1,100 kilos on the Pro 4X, which is more than what you'll get in the equivalent Ranger, Wildtrak, etc. So they've really focused on having a ute that you can go off-road in with those all-terrain tyres and also still carry a load. In terms of the things I was a little disappointed with, no real changes to the engine. I think they really could have done with a little bit more poke there. 450 newton metres is sufficient, but now would have been the perfect opportunity to maybe get a little bit more out of it. I was hoping they'd do a little bit more with the interior. It's still sort of quite hard wearing, and as the price will no doubt increase on these, it kind of feels a little left behind the rest of the packs, such as the new D-Max and BT50 that have been sort of updated with quite a premium looking interior. So we'll be keen to see how all that goes and exactly sort of how this changes in terms of on-road feel as well.
What do you think of the looks compared to the new D-Max, Paul?
Look, I think styling's quite subjective. Tough, don't they? Yeah, styling's subjective. I think that some people are going to love it, some are going to hate it. I love the fact that they've used an LED sort of setup at the rear and at the front, so that looks cool. I'll be keen to see what it's like out on the road and in person. I think the D-Max sort of doesn't have quite an aggressive look to it. It's a little more sort of, I guess, executive, if you could say that. Mm-hmm. I'd be keen to see what Isuzu could actually come up with if they tried to do like a hardcore off-road version as well.
Mm. All right, awesome stuff. We look forward to the chance we get behind the wheel of the Nissan Navara soon. Scully, Genesis. Now, we're going to talk to William Stopford soon about his review of the GV80, but this brand's looking to overtake Lexus in luxury sales race. I wonder when this is going to happen.
That's a good question that I don't know that Genesis can even answer, because it hasn't actually put a time frame on when it wants to overtake Lexus. And the exact quote from the Genesis Motors Australia CEO is that they want 10% market share in Australia. At the moment, Lexus has slightly less than that. So for Genesis to do this, it's obviously going to need to steal market share from the established players. And as smaller than Mercedes and BMW, although it is growing, Lexus is the most logical competitor for it. This is a pretty bold sales target, but I think we've seen with luxury brands in Australia like Infiniti, when you don't really push yourself and really push your brand, it's very easy to fade into the background. So I also think it's a good thing Genesis has set itself this aggressive target and is pushing hard to hit it. I think one of the things that Genesis is going to need to do, and we will hopefully talk about this with Will a bit later on, but is establish a foothold with dealerships and its showrooms and guaranteed future value. So at the moment, what it has is two, what it calls studios, and it's planning to open more in Melbourne and in Brisbane next year. But for someone who wants to buy a Genesis, it's a bit more of a process of discovery than it is if you want to buy a BMW, a Lexus, an Audi, or a Mercedes-Benz. So correcting that's going to be the first thing, and then just getting people across the line on the product, which based on Will's GV80 review is a very good thing, is going to be the second part. But yeah, the fact that Genesis has set itself that goal and is willing to stand by it and actually say it on the record rather than sort of saying it's after incremental small growth or it's just trying to appeal to a niche group of buyers, I think is a really positive sign about its commitment to Australia and how it plans to do business.
Interesting stuff. Indeed, we should take some bets. 10, 20 years.
It'll be a while.
Lexus has been in Australia for a very long time and is only now nudging the market share that it is. So, I don't think we're going to wake up tomorrow and see Genesis with this market share. It could be a slow burn.
All right. Peugeot Australia is still considering bringing the city hatchback, the 208, here. But by the time it does arrive down under, it could be electric. Although Peugeot hasn't made the electric 208 official yet, it has stated it will start moving towards plug-in hybrid technology very soon. Earlier reports suggested we would get the 208 in 2020, but no official word on that date yet. If the electric 208 were to get here, though, it would be a direct rival to the Mini Electric, with its claimed range of 340 kilometres on the more stringent WLTP test cycle. That's with a 50 kilowatt hour lithium ion battery pack. Guys, what price point do we think this would be introduced if it came here electric?
It's French, so probably expensive, more than it needs to be.
I thought you were going to quote us a price in francs there.
I don't know. I just look at stuff like the Renault Zoe and I just think to myself, who prices that and thinks, okay, I think people are going to buy it at that price point. It's almost like they don't look at what else is on the market and what's coming. So I hope that, if they do eventually come to Australia and they price it, it's going to be priced logically and not something crazy.
I think the challenge with this is going to be, you'd probably have to undercut the Mini Electric. The Nissan Leaf is a logical competitor as well at $49,990 before on-road cost. It's got a slightly shorter range and a slightly bigger body, but it's not quite as premium or as sort of like neatly designed as the Peugeot, which has quite a sharp-looking exterior and a really interesting interior. I think this is something we're going to see more of, though. So whether or not it's cheap, Paul, I do think that as micro cars start to die out in Australia, and we've seen a really aggressive shift away from them on the sales charts, besides the Kia Picanto and the MG3, people are just steering away from cars of that size. I think that the logical place for a Peugeot 208 in the lineup is as a really high-spec electric car that fashionable people who live in the city and have a bit of cash can actually can buy and can spread the Peugeot brand in a way that maybe previously they haven't had the opportunity to.
Yeah, just listening to you say that, it sounds like something a marketer would say, and then in reality, it just would never happen that way.
I suppose the precedent for it, and I know we're talking slightly different price points here, but is probably the BMW i3 or something like that, which was very quirky, quite expensive for what it was, but found a home with a niche kind of buyer. I want to say the sort of person who might have bought a Saab 20 years ago.
Yep.
I feel like there's a similar spot for the Peugeot E208, you know, like that in the market. And given Peugeot is not trying to be Toyota, I think that's justifiable, although I'm not a product planner, so I, you know, don't actually have access to the business case.
Scully, lastly, the 2021 Volkswagen Golf R has been revealed, and it's the most powerful Golf ever.
It sure is, and it looks fantastic. This is not a small electric hatchback. It's a Golf, and so it looks like a Golf, obviously, but it's got 235 kilowatts and 420 newton meters from its four-cylinder engine. That's up from the 221 kilowatts and the 400 newton meters you get in Europe from the current model, and well up on the 213 kilowatts and 380 newton meters you get in Australia at the moment.
Big increase.
It's a huge increase. And all the key figures, we have to remember this is a Golf that we don't know quite how it'll be priced, but it'll be around $50,000 based on where the current model is. This is a Golf that'll do 0 to 100 Ks an hour in 4.7 seconds. And with the more powerful performance package optioned, not the more powerful performance package, but the more expensive performance package in Europe, it'll do 270 kilometers an hour.
Wow. That's crazy.
God.
It's a really serious performance car, and it's got some really neat tech like torque vectoring, which lets 100% of the torque on a particular axle be sent to the outside wheel during cornering so that it really tips the nose of the car in. That's proper torque vectoring like the Ford Focus RS used to have, not the negative brake-based system that some manufacturers use to grab an inside wheel. It's also able to monitor the torque distribution and the wheel damping up to 200 times per second. So there's some really clever tech going on underneath the skin to work out what's happening at each corner and monitor it and change it on the fly to make sure the car is riding as softly as it needs to get over bumps or as firmly as it needs to get around the corner at the speed you want it to. It also does have a brake-based system on the front axle to nip at the inside wheel and tip the car in faster, but it sort of sounds like a really high-tech extension of all the clever stuff that's going on in the current Golf R. There's also something that I never thought I'd see from a Golf R, which previously we've thought of as quite a sensible button-down fast car, but it's got a drift mode.
That is interesting. Yeah, I'll be curious to see how they've come up with that because the old one had a Haldex system, which can only send 50% of torque to the rear. So it sounds like whatever the all-wheel drive system is in this, it sounds like it's completely new. So I'm curious to see where they've sourced that from.
I think Volkswagen, with the previous generation Golf GTI, really dipped into some interesting tech with the front differential. It had that, what it called the XDR, I think, and it was capable of shuffling torque and power in all sorts of different directions. So it wouldn't surprise me if the all-wheel drive system in this uses it on the rear axle, something similar that allows Volkswagen to actually do drift mode and the clever torque vectoring. That Golf GTI Performance, the Mark 7 with the tricky differential, was sort of the start of that, and it wouldn't surprise me if this is an extension of that program.
Yeah, it should just mean then that next generation of S3 should have the same thing in theory. If they're going to create one system, they'll probably sort of translate it over to the others. And I think it's the only sort of hot hatch in that price point that actually has that, right, now that the Focus RS is gone?
Yeah, the Focus RS is gone. The Civic Type R is front-wheel drive, but is also a very different type of hot hatch to the Golf R. Mm. And the Megane RS, although it's got its clever rear-wheel steering system and a pretty aggressive locking front differential, is also front drive only. So besides the S3, and I'm just looking through our coverage of the S3 now, and it actually has less power and less torque than the Golf. It's got 228 kilowatts and 400 newton meters, which suggests that maybe they're not going to be quite the same under the skin. Besides the S3, the Golf R is quite unique in that sense. I do wonder, and Paul, I know you've spent a bit of time with the Golf R. Mandy, I think you might have as well from memory. But the thing that's made the Golf R so great and so popular in Australia is the fact that it blends really impressive performance with the fact you can just drive it every day comfortably and not think about it. I do wonder if this higher performance and sort of more aggressive focus of the new one might take away from that slightly. I hope it doesn't, but I think that's going to be the interesting challenge.
Yeah, me too, because that was the thing I really didn't like about A35 and A45. They were really sort of decent in and around town, but out on the highway there was a lot of tyre noise and it just didn't feel like an everyday car, whereas the Golf just always felt like you could just hit it hard whenever you wanted, but then it could just be completely civil and relaxed any other time.
Give me one, please. I want it. When is it here? 2022.
You're going to have to wait a little while. At the moment, 2022 is going to be the arrival of the Golf R hatch and the Golf R wagon. And then Volkswagen's also pushing really hard to get the T-Roc R and the Tiguan R in Australia, which have the same powertrain as the Golf R, but obviously have an SUV body, which is what a lot of people want. I personally love the idea of parents rocking up on the school run with their Tiguan R and blowing away hybrid RAV4s and naturally aspirated Tucsons. It's a pretty cool thought.
I think it is too. All right, that wraps up this week's car news. Head to carexpert.com.au to read more. And if you've got anything to say, you can put them in the comments below. Mike Costello, hello.
Hello, Mandy. Hello, team.
New car sales figures for October were released this week. But before we talk about VFACTS, let's touch a little on an article you wrote, Moco, about a mandatory law becoming likely for vehicle data sharing. First of all, can you explain what is vehicle data sharing?
It sounds incredibly dry, doesn't it? And every time I, you know, write a story on this, I just imagine half of our readers sort of falling asleep where they sit. But it's actually a pretty important deal. So for a very long time, there's been a little bit of argy-bargy where car manufacturers make most of their profit servicing vehicles. And it's in their interest to make sure that people who buy vehicles return to the dealer to get them serviced. But there's an army of independent repairers out there from, you know, Ultra Tune and Kmart Tire and Auto all the way down to your, you know, backyard garage who want to be able to fix your vehicle as well. And it's important to say that warranties generally should not be contingent on where you get your car serviced. But car manufacturers are making their cars so complex today that part of servicing them is plugging them into a diagnostic machine which finds, you know, software issues and bugs in the code to actually repair these high-tech vehicles. It's not just about spinning spanners like perhaps it was a few decades ago. So this law that is likely to happen very soon basically enshrines in the law that car brands have to sell the relevant data to repair all of their vehicles to an independent repairer who wants the data. Now, up until now, car manufacturers have been able to sell that data, but there hasn't been any law on the books saying that they could withhold that data if they wanted to. So this really just, I guess, formalizes an arrangement that by and large existed. It's been pushed really hard by a lot of, you know, bodies out there devoted to the, you know, the independent repairers. There's the AAAA, the MTAA, there's the VACC, there's all these different acronyms, all of whom look after the independent repair sector. This has been signed off by Federal Treasurer Josh Frydenberg now, and it's going to go through the typical process that it has to go through to get passed by Parliament. But within a year or so, this should all be locked into stone. And there's been a lot of celebration from independent repairers. And the car industry, represented by the Federal Chamber of Automotive Industry, has said that it's fine with it. You know, we're all good. People are going to service their cars at dealers more often than not anyway. But I'm sure that there are a few brands that are a little bit disappointed behind the scenes.
Moco, what does this mean when it comes to electric vehicles? Because previously when we've talked to manufacturers about this issue, one of the things that's worried them is it's quite dangerous to work on the high voltage batteries in those cars.
Yeah.
What is there anything specifically related to electric vehicles that's changed, or the relationship between the manufacturers and the independent retailers that's changed that's got this across the line?
Well, so often you see legislation a little bit behind technology, right? And EVs are still an infant technology in Australia. The vast majority of people who own new vehicles, and particularly those who own expensive vehicles, still service their vehicles at the dealership. So for the majority of people buying EVs, I imagine they're probably not going to be heading down to your corner shop mechanic to get it fixed. But of course, if an independent repairer is going to be working on EVs, there's a whole bunch of legal requirements they have to overcome to work on those vehicles.
And especially as we move into this world, there's going to be a whole sequence of new protective laws coming into place to mandate that you're not putting your first year apprentice in a dangerous position with a highly, you know, powerful electric vehicle. So there's going to have to be new legislation made, but there hasn't been anything specifically talked about regarding EVs yet.
So I wonder as well, just on this front, what happens if a manufacturer goes, no, I'd rather not do that? Is it law? Yeah. Are they not allowed to sell cars anymore? What's the story?
That's a really interesting question. Look, and it's sort of from my understanding, having spoken to a few people on both sides of the argument, is that a lot of that's still being worked through. So one thing that's not being talked about is price caps or price ceilings. I think the preference is that the different industries can negotiate some sort of agreed subscription price to get the data. If there is a car manufacturer that doesn't want to play ball, I honestly don't know if there's anything in place yet sort of controlling them. There might be a brand that decides to test the market and call the bluff of the independent repairers, although generally it's a pretty collegial relationship where possible. But if this is going to become legislation, there's going to have to be some teeth attached to it, right? There's going to have to be some bite, whether it's financial penalties or something else. The specifics of that don't seem to have been revealed yet. And if they have, I don't know them. But I think that's being worked through.
And in terms of the outcome for people who do want to service their cars at the manufacturer, presumably this is going to mean better cap price servicing offers that last longer. Because if a manufacturer now needs to keep someone in the service network, they don't have the argument that a private mechanic doesn't have the same information or the same quality of detail as they do.
Well, and this is the key, isn't it? So the whole reason for this that is being pushed is that competition factor, that if a customer has the luxury of choice and they can choose, I want to get my, you know, I've bought a new Hyundai, I want to service at my Hyundai dealer, or I might want to service at an independent repairer. If you have that choice, that creates competition, which in turn is a really powerful way to push down pricing. The last thing you want is manufacturers essentially having a monopoly on how to repair their vehicles, because if you do that, they can essentially charge whatever the hell they want. Not saying that they will, but they can. So the only way to drive pricing down for consumers is competition. It's likely, and for most people I've spoken to have said this, that general behavior will remain, which is that most people with new vehicles within 5 years of age will keep servicing at the dealer. And then as they age, they'll take them to an independent because, you know, that's sort of the traditional split. But theoretically, it should keep pricing down.
All right. We might move on now to October VFACTS for the new car sales figures of last month. Still a bit of a decline on sales, Moco, but surprisingly not as much as we'd thought.
Yeah, well, I mean, unsurprisingly, it's been a disastrous year for car dealers around the country, particularly here in Victoria, but all over the nation. And that's still the case. So annual sales are down by 18.8% on a pretty crappy 2019. But they only declined by 1.5% in October to 81,220 units. But where it gets really interesting is Victoria, where dealerships until very recently were closed due to the stage four COVID restrictions, is down about 30%. And Tassie's also struggling. But the ACT, New South Wales, Northern Territory, Queensland, South Australia and WA all grew really strongly. In fact, all of those states bar New South Wales grew by double-digit percentages. So if you take out Victoria, which has obviously been a bit of a basket case for a number of reasons lately, Australia is actually recovering quite significantly. The Federal Chamber of Automotive Industry has called it green shoots, which I think is being pretty modest. I think we are starting to see the uptick that we've seen for some time and that we've been expecting for some time. And there's no doubt that, you know, demand for vehicles didn't really go away. It was just the ability for people to access vehicles that went away. So if we look at the key points outside of that, there have been 31 successive months of sales decline, although October came very close to breaking that trend. Toyota for October was incredibly dominant with 24% total market share. Now, there are 70 brands competing for about a million sales, and one of them owns a quarter of all those sales. So you can see how hard it is for some of the smaller brands out there. Toyota also made five of the top 10 selling individual models, Hilux, Corolla, RAV4, and I've forgotten the other two, Prado and Land Cruiser. The top vehicles were Hilux, Ranger, RAV4, Prado and Corolla. Interestingly enough, plug-in hybrids, hybrids and EVs were all well up over their October 2019 tallies. The private market was up by 10%, while business and fleets are still down and rental business is way down, quite unsurprisingly. SUVs owned more than 50% total market share, which if you told somebody that 5 years ago, they'd laugh in your face. And sales of vehicles imported from China more than doubled over October 2019's tally, and China is now a top five trading partner when it comes to vehicles sold.
Just a question on D-Max. Where did that land last month?
Oh, D-Max did super well. So I actually was really happy to see that for Isuzu because it's a great new product. It finished sixth overall on the charts. Wow. So one position outside of the top five. That's the highest position that car's had in my memory. It actually beat the Mazda CX-5 into sixth place with 1,932 sales. That's up 51.5% year-on-year.
That's with
year.
Constrained supply as well, isn't it?
Well, last time I spoke to a dealer, it was 6 months wait now on the X-Terrain, and that's only going to grow because of the keenness of the pricing. Mm. So it's now clearly the number three ute. Obviously, you've got Hilux and Ranger up the top of the charts and they're kind of unconquerable at this stage, but D-Max, seriously solid start.
Well, actually, just a quick question for you on D-Max. We've got there's a comparison that you're working on at the moment that includes D-Max, and the thing that surprises me, why would anyone buy an LSU when the on-road price is actually more than the driveway price of an X-Terrain? Yes.
It's that crazy thing with Isuzu, isn't it, where they've got a crazy sharp 58,990 drive away on the X-Terrain, whereas the LSU, there is no sort of standardized national drive away price on it, so you're paying full whack on top of the list price plus all your taxes and charges. And as you say, now, in the real world, clearly you're not going to pay that. I mean, clearly you go into a dealer and say, what, you're charging me more for a less well-equipped vehicle when there's waiting lists? I mean, obviously there's going to be discounts to be had, but the fact of the matter is you're going to have to talk to a dealer to get that deal. And a lot of people don't want to do that. They just want to know what it's going to bloody cost. So Isuzu does need to pull its finger out there and actually offer standardized pricing across the range, because right now I can go on the public website of Ford and get an XLT Ranger for less than an LSU D-Max, even though in the real world, the situation would be reversed.
Mm. How about the BT50, which is the same under the skin as the D-Max, but has launched more recently, and Mazda seemed pretty confident in its supply chain for the car?
Yeah, very modest start. So 373 4x4s and 76 4x2s sold for the month, but I suspect a lot of that was just getting that first wave of supply into the network. They've obviously got enough to put plates on for press cars and to have dealer test drive vehicles, but it would seem to me that they haven't actually sold a great deal yet based on those numbers. Traditionally, the BT50 doesn't sell as well as your D-Max and obviously your Hilux and your Ranger, but it is usually there or thereabouts with the Navaras of the world. And I suspect this new one will be more popular again because it is pretty keenly priced for what it is. So I reckon the first month is a bit average, but I think next month you'll see quite a spike.
Any little fun facts that you found in last month's report?
Oh, there's always some fun facts to find, aren't there? I thought the private buyer figure was really interesting, but I also thought the growth of alternate fuels was interesting. So there were 45,000 petrol vehicles and 27,000 diesel vehicles sold. Petrol vehicles are well down. Diesels were slightly up because of the ute boom. But hybrid cars grew by 111% for the month, thanks mostly to Toyota. Electric vehicles grew 5%. And they're up 100% for the year. And that excludes Tesla, who still doesn't disclose figures. And plug-in hybrids grew by more than 100% or more than doubled for the month. And we're seeing a lot of new plug-in hybrid offerings launch into the market alongside new EVs. And even though the overall market is down, the market for alternate fueled cars is well and truly up. The other one, of course, is Chinese manufacturers. We've spoken about this before, but both MG and LDV were in the top 20 brands. MG outsold Suzuki, LDV outsold Renault. I mean, these are brands that are no longer sort of outsiders. They're really part of the establishment set now. And, we're only seeing those brands grow even faster. So they're the two things I'm really keeping an eye on at the moment.
Awesome. You can read both those stories that Mogo covered now up at carexpert.com.au. Thank you very much, Mike Costello.
Thank you, guys.
Korean luxury car maker Genesis has finally released what it so badly needed, an SUV. It's called the GV80 and it's all brand new. William Stopford got the behind the wheel and we're dying to hear what it was like. Hello, Will.
Hi, Mandy. How are you?
Very well. Let's start off with your first impressions. What did you think of the car?
Good overall, which is exactly what Genesis needs it to be, because this is going to be its most important product, at least initially, until the smaller GV70 comes online next year. So Genesis launched here last year with two sedans, unfortunately for Genesis, the market has shifted so far away from sedans that it hasn't really been able to make much of an impact yet. That also hasn't been helped by the fact that they've technically only had one or two retail sales environments. So the GV80 is going to be really important for Genesis. Now, if you're not aware of where the GV80 sits in the market, it's effectively Genesis's rival for the BMW X5, the Mercedes-Benz GLE, also the Lexus RX, Volkswagen Touareg, whereas next year the GV70 is going to come online and that's going to be their rival for the BMW X3, the Audi Q5. So Genesis really needed SUVs. It finally has an SUV and it has another one coming next year. And the GV80 is a very, very impressive SUV.
Will, can you run us through the sale model? I know you mentioned they only had two sort of presences. It sounds a bit to me a little bit like Tesla, where you basically order the car online and you go pick it up from a place. Is it similar to that? Can you still buy a car in store? Do you still test drive in store? How does that whole process work? I mean, if I wanted to buy one right now in Melbourne, how would I go about doing that? How do I test drive it and so on?
So basically, Genesis, they opened last year with a studio, as they call it, which is run by the company. It's not like a separate dealer franchise or anything like that. Then they followed it up with two, so that was in Sydney, and then they followed it up with two test drive centers, which are a little bit more like a conventional dealership where you can, of course, go and test drive the vehicle. They are opening another Melbourne, they are opening their first studio in Melbourne, and then they'll be opening one in Brisbane next year, I believe. But effectively, if you live anywhere else in Australia, right, you don't have anywhere to go in theory. However, Genesis has this program called Genesis to You, where you can contact them and say, hey, look, I'm really curious about this GV80. Can I please test drive it? And they will actually bring one to you. Now, if you're up in like Cape York, that might be a bit of a problem. But if you're within, I believe it's like 70 kilometers of a major metro area, somebody from Genesis will come along with the car. They'll let you drive it. And that way you can see if it's the car for you.
Yeah. How does that system work? If they're coming to you, do you then sit in the car with the person that delivers it and go for a drive with them? Or do you get to go on your own? What's the sort of...
That's a really good question. My understanding is they will let you... like have the car for a little while, but I'm actually not 100% sure about that one, Paul.
Okay. I'd be curious because it's like, okay, well, maybe I'll just invite the guy in. He can sit and watch a bit of telly on the couch while I go for a drive in the car. I'll be curious to see how it works because, to be honest, this is one of the things that I find the hardest. When we help people, you know, buy a new car, a lot of people hate dealing with dealers because they're very pushy. They want to come with you in the car and it's just – you just don't feel very comfortable then buying the car. So hopefully they've been able to crack it here. Again, I'm just referring to Tesla because I just know the way this experience works, but you basically rock up, they remotely unlock the car and then you just disappear and go do your own thing. And they can sort of deliver the car as well. They do the mobile servicing. So I'm hoping that Genesis is a bit like that where, you know, it's quite a hands-off thing and you don't really need to be interacting with a salesperson or someone that's going to be pushy and trying to get you to buy this car.
Yeah, my understanding is they will actually leave it with you, but I don't want to say that how long they will leave it with you for, just in case I am wrong. But that is my understanding, that they will bring it to you. And it's the same thing with their various their after-sales package is actually really good for a luxury brand as well. So if you do actually go ahead and buy a Genesis and you need to have it serviced, they'll actually come with a Genesis loan car. They'll pick up yours. They'll leave you with another Genesis to drive in That's the meantime. Heavy. Yeah, exactly, which is really good. And in addition, you know, Genesis has got a 5-year warranty. I know in the era of 7 and 10 year warranties, that doesn't sound that impressive, but for the luxury brand segment, for the luxury market, that's actually pretty good. 5 years of complimentary servicing as well, scheduled servicing. So the after sales package really does stack up. It's just that initial getting there. And I think perhaps one concern that Genesis may have is, well, they're offering this Genesis to You service, which makes it just so easy. But some people might be like, oh, I don't know. I don't really want to bother them. You know, that's what if they bring it out and I'm not interested? But their whole idea is they're trying to, as they reminded me a lot on the launch, they're trying to make it easier and easier for people to buy a car. So that certainly sounds a lot better than going schlepping yourself all the way to a showroom and you know sitting in the car for the test drive with the dealer while they're yakking away. This seems, as you say, a little bit more hands-off and a little bit more customer-friendly.
So, Will, the GV80 is all new for Genesis. It's on a new platform. It's got a new styling direction. The interior is all new. In person, does it actually have the quality feel and a sort of distinctive look that we get the sense it does in the pictures?
It does. It's a really attractive car.
Sorry, Paul's just up. Paul's allergic to good taste.
It seems to divide opinion because I think Moco had a similar reaction as well.
Well, then I know it's not good looking. Yeah,
I think it's a very good looking car. I think it looks a lot smaller in person than say an X5 or a GLE because it's got quite a sleek, as they call it, parabolic roofline that tapers down. It's the detailing is really lovely. That grille is really nice. They've got Genesis calls the quad lamps, which are those kind of bisected headlights, and that design element carries through to the fender vents and indicators and the taillights as well. Genesis has established a design identity really quickly. So once you actually do figure out what a Genesis is, which is certainly something that the brand is working on, you'll instantly recognize it as a Genesis, which I think is important.
And has it managed to shed some of those Hyundai roots on the inside? Because that was always a challenge for Infiniti in Australia, managing to convince people it wasn't just a fancy Nissan, it was actually its own thing. And I know the first Genesis products we had here, although they were very nice to drive, really had some quite clear Hyundai roots.
Yeah. I remember driving a G70 earlier this year. And look, the infotainment system worked really well. However, it was very clearly an infotainment system that you'd get in any number of Hyundai products. So there's an entirely new user interface for the, from memory, 14.5-inch touchscreen infotainment system. There's virtually nothing Hyundai about the interior. I didn't really notice much in the way of, like, for example, switch gear that looked like it was from a Hyundai. You've got this lovely tempered glass rotary dial and this kind of tempered glass infotainment dial thing, which are really lovely. And the interior quality is top notch. Like everything from the bottom of the doors to the glove box lid is covered in soft touch plastic. If it's not covered in that, it's covered in leather. There's leather on the dash, leather on the center console and the doors. And where I think the GV80 really stands out in the segment is the colorways that are available in the interior. There was one which all through the launch, I'm like, can I sit in one? But people kept getting it first. And I finally got to drive it on the way back to the airport. But it had there's this exclusive colorway with the luxury package called Smoky Green. And it's these like dark green leather seats with a brown dashboard. And it's really clubby and lovely and really nice. So there's a lot of really interesting color schemes there. Basically all of the interior colors are two-tone except for black. And if you buy a GV80 and buy a black interior, I don't understand why you're so boring.
Okay, I've got one quick question for you. I've experienced some incredible BMW-esque depreciation with my Supra, even though it wears a Toyota badge. What is Genesis doing about protection of resale value? Because that would be immediately the reason I would present for not buying this over one of the established European brands. Do they have a guaranteed resale program in place, or are they thinking about doing something like that?
It is coming. I couldn't get many details on it, but I do know that it is coming and they say it is coming soon. So I think, you know, I dare say they probably would have liked to have launched with that, but they have assured that they are introducing that because, yes, that is absolutely one of the first and foremost concerns that people have about buying a Genesis. Another kind of concern that people have been raising in the comments section, and Genesis articles often seem to generate some pretty lively discussion, people talking about the price point. Now, the GV80 does undercut German rivals. But the difference is, so we were talking about Genesis' after sales program being a little bit different from the Germans. What's also different is, well, I know Mercedes will be doing this soon, but they actually have a fixed pricing model. So you can't just go in there and wheel a deal and haggle thousands off the price or just have thousands slashed off the price before you even walk in the showroom. That's just not how it works. But the GV80, even it's effectively one trim level across the range, and you can add a $10,000 luxury package, which adds absolutely anything else that you can think of. But it's extremely well equipped, and it starts at $90,000. Now, I know that sounds like a lot for a new brand that a lot of Australians haven't heard about, but that still undercuts, if we're talking just list price alone, that undercuts German rivals by more than 10 grand. And if we're talking spec for spec, the GV80 stacks up even better.
Is it worth that price, do you think, Will?
I think so. But look, the thing about first drives is they are limited. I mean, granted, we were driving it all day, so I mean, not that limited. But it would be really nice to get one of these in the garage for a week, and preferably like test it back to back with one of those German rivals, which, look, at the end of the day, are going to outsell it considerably. Genesis is still finding its feet. Its CEO, Junhyo, has said that he wants to eventually have 10% of the luxury car market in Australia, which is an ambitious goal because that's actually more than Lexus currently has. But for a while yet, it's hard catching up with the Germans. Like, honestly, even if the Germans didn't make excellent cars, which they do, they have got years and years and years of prestige and absolutely sparkling reputation and covetability that all these upstart brands have to fight against. And if we look over in Europe, for example, Lexus has been at it for 30 years and is still really struggling over there compared to the Germans. So It's a long road ahead for Genesis, but that's why their executives keep saying it's all about the product, it's all about the product, and the product stacks up really nicely.
So just to drill down on that a little bit more, Will, and I know that this is kind of covering something we've talked about, but no matter how good the product is, the challenge is saying to someone who has $100,000 to spend on an SUV, please buy one of ours instead of buying an X5. Because no matter how good the product is, you've got to beat the incumbent to actually do it, which we're seeing in the US at the moment. why would you buy a Genesis GV80 instead of an X5 or a Q7 or a GLE, all of which are beautifully put together, all of which have very nice tech and all of which drive really well?
And that is a really tough question there. It's not like it's just some pale copy of them. Genesis could have introduced an SUV that just looks effectively like an X5 or a GLE inside and out, but they've taken a different tack there. It's got a very distinctive design inside and out, which I think does help it stand out. The fact that it does represent, I would say, better value than base model Germans does help as well. But I see exactly what you're saying, and that is something Genesis is going to have to continue to fight against, because one, people don't know about the brand; two, where can they go to check out the cars? And three, while their cars are priced not identically to the Germans, but they're getting up there.
Just before we wrap up, Will, how did it drive?
Very smoothly. So there's actually three engines in the range. There's a turbocharged 2.5-litre four-cylinder, a turbocharged 3.5-litre V6, and a 3-litre turbo diesel inline six. And there's not a dud in the bunch. They all use an in-house designed 8-speed automatic. The 2.5 is available with rear-wheel drive, but the others are all-wheel drive. And they're all really smooth, but I'd give the nod to the diesel. It just had, you know, wonderful torque, wonderful smooth power delivery. It was so quiet, and of course it was the most fuel efficient of the bunch, so that would be my pick. And that is 103,600 before on roads and the luxury package adds 10 grand to that.
Nice. You can read the review of the Genesis GV80 now up at carexpert.com.au. William Stopford, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That brings an end to this week's podcast. What have we got coming up at carexpert.com.au over the next week or so, Scully?
So one that I'm most excited about is the GT3 RS performance review. I love reading Atco's stuff, and he's taken the most track-focused Porsche you can buy to the track, which is a good place for it, given most of them drive up and down Chapel Street in first gear. And on Sunday, there's a comparison between the Kia Sorento GT line and the Mazda CX-9 GT, two very big, very family-oriented SUVs with very different approaches. That's another good read. And then next week, we've got a review of the Volkswagen T-Roc 140 TSI Sport. Paul's already done a video about that car, but JWO has taken a fully optioned one up as opposed to the base model that Will reviewed a few weeks ago. And on Friday next week, we'll also have a review of the updated Honda CR-V. I picked that one up today, but I can't tell you how it drives just yet.
Oh, there you go. I'm waiting with bated breath. In terms of the cars that we have coming through the garage, we were actually meant to be driving the new Great Wall Ute, but it's been delayed by a week at this stage.
Oh, was it built in Nevada?
Very good. That joke could date quite a lot. Or well, maybe not. You never know. So we'll be having a drive of that as soon as we can get our hands on it. But we will be behind the wheel of the new i30 hatch, and we have a comparison also that's being written next week between the T-Roc and the CX-30 Sky Active X, which should be good fun. We're also shooting something interesting. So a little while back, we shot a video comparing headlights. And this time around, we're actually comparing parking systems. So, I'll have a bit more about that in a couple of weeks, but we're filming that next week and looking forward to it.
Cool. As always, if you have any feedback for us, you can shoot us an email, podcast@carexpert.com.au. And a big thank you to Paul Marrick and Scott Colley.
Thank you.
Thank you.